Open your Bibles, please, to the book of Esther. We're going to be starting the book of Esther today. As I mentioned in the last class, when we finished Ezra chapter 6, the next thing that happens chronologically is the book of Esther. And then after the book of Esther, we'll come back to Ezra and pick up chronologically with what happens in chapter 7 through the end of the book of Ezra. Esther is a strange book. And when most people think of Esther, they probably don't think of it as being a particularly strange book. But if Esther is not the strangest book in the Bible, it must be in the top two or three. Most commentaries on the book of Ezra begin with the question, what kind of book is Esther? And right there is kind of an odd question to begin with a book. You don't really hear that question too often with a lot of other books of the Bible, but you do hear that with Esther. And there are about as many answers to that question as there are commentaries. Is it history? Is it fiction? Is it historical fiction? Is it comedy? Is it a Persian chronicle? Is it a Greek romance? Is it a carnival tale? Is it a wisdom tale? Is it burlesque? Each of those answers appears in at least one commentary about the book of Esther. About all the commentators can agree upon is that the book of Esther is a strange book. Let's look at some examples of why Esther is strange. Although the heathen king of Persia is mentioned 190 times in 167 verses, 29 times by name in the book of Esther, God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. There's not even a divine title or a pronoun referring to God in the book of Esther. There is likewise no mention of God's commands or of his relationship with his people. There's no mention of Satan. There's no mention of angels. There's no mention of the covenant. Unlike the book of Daniel, no one prays in the book of Esther that we're told about. And no one has a vision in the book of Esther. There are no miracles in the book of Esther. Other than the fact that the book is about the Jewish people, there's nothing Jewish about it in a religious sense. There's no apparent concern for the law in the book of Esther. Now, Haman does say in chapter 3, verse 8, that their laws are diverse from all people, but that's about it. Although the book was written after the events we've studied in Ezra 1 through 6, there's no mention of Jerusalem, and there's no mention of the temple in the book of Esther. Well, here's what one commentator said about it. If one went through the text and replaced every occurrence of the word Jews with the name of some other ethnic group, there would be no reason to think that the story had anything at all to do with the Bible. The lack of religious language in the book is highly unusual for books of that time, and it's certainly intentional. And we'll talk about why it's there in a moment. And in fact, as one commentator noted, God seems to lurk everywhere in the background of the book of Esther, but he's not mentioned by name. Let's continue looking at some reasons why this book is strange. Esther is the only book in the Old Testament that was not found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, most people think that's because the Essenes did not practice the Feast of Purim, which we'll see in this book of Esther, was started here in Esther. But for whatever reason, it's the only book not found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. The book of Esther is never cited in the New Testament. It's never alluded to in the New Testament. Neither Esther nor Mordecai is ever mentioned anywhere else in the Bible. Now, as we discussed, there is a Mordecai in Ezra 2, verse 2, but as we also discussed, that's not the same Mordecai we're meeting here in Esther. Esther is one of only two books in the Bible named for a woman, the other, of course, being Ruth. Esther has the longest verse in the Bible, for you statisticians among us here, Esther 8, verse 9. It's 78 words, the longest verse in the Bible. Surprisingly, one of the central themes in the book of Esther, one of its central themes is feasting. The Hebrew word for feast or banquet occurs nearly as many times in Esther as it does in the rest of the Old Testament combined. And as we just said, the Feast of Purim comes from Esther, and it's one of the two Jewish feasts not in the law of Moses, the other being Hanukkah. Esther is the only Old Testament book describing events that take place entirely in Persia. In fact, every scene in Esther, except for a couple of brief episodes in Haman's house and one brief episode about a Jewish victory in chapter 9, every other scene takes place in the royal court of Persia, with some of them in the throne room and some of them in the king's private quarters. In the rest of the Old Testament, Jews are introduced by giving the name of their father or by the name of their tribe, while foreigners are introduced by giving the name of their country or their ethnicity. For example, Uriah the Hittite or Ruth the Moabitess. But in Esther, Mordecai is called Mordecai the Jew 6 times. In fact, it's the only 6 times that the phrase "the Jew" appears in your Old Testament. The characters in Esther are presented differently from each other. With Haman, for example, we're told his motives. We're told his drives. We're told his ambitions. As one commentary said, Haman is allowed no mysteries in the book of Esther. He is completely opened up for us to see. But with Mordecai and Esther, we see only their words and their actions, and we're left to wonder as to their motives. For example, we're never told why Mordecai refused to give honor to Haman at the beginning of that book. And that's really what kicks off all of the events that follow. And we're never told. We might be able to guess, but we're never told why he did that. On one level, Esther is a very simple tale. But on another level, it is incredibly structured. It has an incredibly detailed structure. In fact, you can see that in your handout today. If you look at your handout, it has thesis after thesis met by antithesis after antithesis as it revolves around a key event in chapter 6. It has a beautiful, detailed structure. There's very little direct speech in the book of Esther. And Esther's often compared with Ruth, but in this situation, Esther and Ruth are very, very different. In Ruth, the plot is advanced through dialogue, people talking back and forth, and we're given what they said. In Esther, the plot is advanced through narration. We're told what they did. We all remember Mordecai's famous speech in chapter 4. Very memorable, famous speech by Mordecai. What you may not remember is that is in fact Mordecai's only speech. That's the only example of direct speech by Mordecai in the book of Esther. He's mentioned by name 56 times, but that's it in chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. So in Esther, the plot is driven through narration. The first chapter of Esther has not a word to say about God or God's people, but rather is focused on pagan characters in a pagan event in the pagan world. It's certainly an event that will prove to be very important in the book of Esther, but particularly in the first chapter, we're seeing a window into the pagan world where God's people are wholly absent. So if you put all these together, I think you may agree that Esther is a very strange book. Also a very interesting book, but it's a strange book. It's also a very meaningful book, particularly to those who are suffering persecution. We're going to see as our lessons proceed how meaningful it is to Christians, but it is a very meaningful book to Jews as well, and also today, to Jews today, it's very meaningful, particularly when people are trying to destroy them. And when they face threats of destruction, as they did in Esther's day through Haman, and as they did in our own day through Hitler. And in fact, the Nazis forbade the reading of Esther in the concentration camps. But the Jewish prisoners, we're told, wrote the book down from memory and would read it in secret on Purim, the Feast of Purim, in the concentration camps. Very meaningful book. So let's then get to our question, what kind of book is Esther? And as I mentioned, that's a strange question to ask. You don't often ask, well, what kind of book is Exodus or what kind of book is Ezra? We didn't ask that question, but we have to ask it with Esther because it's the first question that all commentaries deal with. What are we looking at when we look at the book of Esther? Well, some argue that Esther is a historical narrative. That is, Esther contains an accurate account of a series of events that took place at the stated time in the stated place. And not wanting to keep anyone in suspense, that's where we're going to end up, that it's a historical narrative. But before we do, I want to consider what some of the other people have said about the book of Esther. Some argue that it's a historical novel. That is, they say the author was writing about a real historical event, but the author wrote about it with some poetic license and some creativity. So it's really a novel combined with history. And others say, nope, there's really no history to it. It's a total fictional narrative, they say. It's just a creative short story meant to either entertain or to teach. But it's not meant to convey an actual history. That's what others say. And some say, no, that's all wrong. Esther is a comedy. And no one disputes that some of the events in Esther are some of the funniest events in the Bible. We'll see that as we study it. But they point to him and say, well, that's all it is. It's just a comedy. And they point to Haman and the king as playing the megalomaniac and the buffoon. And they point to many amusing coincidences in the book and parallels and reverses. And they say it's just a comedy. And others say, it's not a comedy. It's a fictional narrative. It's a Persian tale. It's a burlesque. They're just all different, all over the map. But each of those proposals that I just listed, except for the first one, where we're going to end up, each of the others has something in common. They all say that Esther is fictional to some degree, either wholly fictional or partly fictional, but they say there's fiction woven into the book of Esther. And we're going to deny that. We're going to say, no, it's a history. It's what it claims to be. It's a history. But those who argue in favor of fiction and against Esther being history, those arguments are based primarily not on evidence so much as on a lack of evidence. They say, well, there's really no confirming evidence of the events we see in Esther. We don't find them in Herodotus, for example. We don't find them in contemporary archaeological discoveries, for example. That's what they'll tell us. They also have a second complaint, though. They say the events in the book of Esther are so improbable that they could never have occurred, is what they say. They're just too improbable, too wild for them to have occurred. Well, let's treat both of those and look at and see what we can say about them. As for the absence of evidence, we've seen that one before. And let me tell you, those who bet against the Bible are going to lose every single time. And archaeology has uncovered evidence after evidence of people and places that the critics said never existed. And archaeology will finally come up and they'll say, well, okay, I guess they existed. But none of these other people exist, and then they'll keep saying it until something's found. So people who bet against the Bible are going to be the loser every time. As for the probabilities involved, God is certainly not named in the book, but God is present in the book of Esther. And what may seem like improbable coincidences make perfect sense when they're viewed as God's providence working out His plan in the book of Esther. And we're going to see that one of the major themes of this book is God's providence in action. Those who argue the book is not historical, they very often point to contradictions they see between Esther and contemporary histories, most notably the history of Herodotus. We've mentioned Herodotus before. Now, of course, it never occurs to any of them that perhaps it's Herodotus that's mistaken. It never seems to dawn on them, but that is a possibility. It could be that Herodotus was mistaken, but let's look at some of those supposed contradictions. For example, Herodotus says that Xerxes' queen was Amestris, not Vashti and not Esther, the two that are mentioned here. It says an Amestris. So they say, well, there's a contradiction. They also say that Herodotus says Persia was divided into 20 satrapies, whereas Esther says it was divided into 127 provinces. And they say, well, there's a contradiction. Now, those who were listening carefully noticed that I said satrapies from Herodotus and provinces from Esther, a different word, and yet they still say, no, that's a contradiction. But even if we assume that Herodotus was correct, these supposed difficulties still have explanations. For example, the Amestris being the first queen. Well, some argue that's just another name for Vashti. And others say, no, maybe the king had multiple queens, another possibility. Now, some have tried to argue that Amestris was the same as Esther, but I don't think we can go there because we know from history that Amestris was not a very good character, although she may have had some good points, particularly if it ends up that she was the same as Vashti, who we'll read about in the first two chapters. Now, while it's true that Herodotus does not mention Esther, and Herodotus does not mention Mordecai, and Herodotus does not mention Vashti, you know what? Herodotus also did not mention Belshazzar, and that's someone else that the critics said never existed. And guess what? Archaeologists found evidence of him from the book of Daniel, and they dug up some plaques with his name on it. So the same may happen for the characters in the book of Esther. There are some historical facts in the book of Esther, though, that are kind of changing this critical climate. As we learn more about the times, we're starting to, I think the critics, are starting to appreciate the book of Esther more and understand that it, in fact, does have some good historical records in the book of Esther. For example, in Esther 3, verse 7, Haman cast lots to see what to do with the Israelites, the Jews. And he cast the lots in the first month of the year to determine a date on which to execute his plans, which happens to be at the end of the year. And critics once pointed to that and said, well, that's so improbable. Why would he do that on the first month of the year for something that's not going to happen until the end of the year? Why all this time in between? And they pointed to that as an example of some improbability in the book of Esther. Well, guess what? They have now uncovered evidence that, in fact, ancient kings, particularly Assyria, but they think it's also for these Persian kings, they would, at the beginning of the year, cast lots to determine what they were going to do throughout the entire year. They would do all the lot casting at the beginning of the year, and it would tell them what to do throughout the year. That matches perfectly with what we see here in the book of Esther. It might explain how our own Congress seems to get things done, but I don't know if that's the case or not. But it certainly matches with the book of Esther, casting lots at the beginning of the year to determine what they're going to do throughout the year. The book also agrees very well with what we know now about King Xerxes from other sources. The greatness of his empire, his quick and sometimes irrational temper, his almost unlimited promises and generous gifts to others, his drunken feast, even his efficient postal system, chapter 3, verse 13. We know these are now true about Xerxes from other sources, and they're all in the book of Esther. As I mentioned, details such as this have tended to change the critical climate. It used to be a lot of commentaries were saying, it's just fiction. It's just all fiction. Now it's very, very few that would say that. The pendulum is swinging back toward history. It hasn't come all the way back with most of the commentaries. Most of them still end up with historical novel. But it's swinging in the right direction, going back toward what it actually is, which is history, actual history. We're, of course, going to take the position here that Esther is not any sort of a novel. There's nothing fictional about it. It is historical narrative describing actual events and actual people. And let me list at least four reasons why we're going to take that approach. First, there is no indication in this book that it is intended to be taken in any way other than a straightforward narrative of events that occurred. It goes to great lengths to include places and people and names and events and details. It's a history. It's putting itself forward as a history. And let me ask you, if this book is not a history, then how do we distinguish it from any of the other historical books in the Bible? For those who say this one is fictional, what keeps them from saying Ezra is fictional? They're all purporting to be history. In fact, they are histories. Second, research has repeatedly demonstrated that Esther is an accurate history of Persian affairs and Persian culture. And as I mentioned, history is catching up to the book of Esther in that regard. Third, although we have no record of Jesus ever mentioning Esther, Jesus' view of the Old Testament is that it is an unquestionably reliable guide to past events. That's Jesus' view of the Old Testament. He mentions Abel. He mentions Noah. He mentions Abraham. He mentions Sodom. He mentions Gomorrah. He mentions Lot. He mentions Isaac. He mentions Jacob. He mentions David, and on and on and on, as real historical of characters from history. As one commentator said, it is not too much to say that Jesus accepted without reservation the entire historical fabric of the Old Testament, including those aspects of it most troublesome to modern minds. And as Christians, we will accept what Jesus told us as true, and because Jesus knew what was true. And if he says it's history, it's history. And Jesus certainly treated the Old Testament as history. Fourth, the Bible is the inspired Word of God. Although there are within it some fictional accounts that are intended to teach, the parables, for example, come to mind. They are always clearly indicated as such. For example, then he began to speak unto them parables. We are told these are parables, and then we are told the parable. There is no such indication in the book of Esther. So we will take it for what it claims to be, a true history of actual events. And in fact, the very first words in the book are not once upon a time. They are now it came to pass. And it did come to pass. And Esther is history. Now, one of the main objections raised against this by some, as I mentioned, is that they say the events in Esther are just too unlikely to be true. Esther's in the right place at the right time when Vashti is deposed and when Haman's evil plans come to light. When the king cannot sleep and he asks for historical documents to be read, the page just happens to fall upon Mordecai's role in foiling a plot against the king. As the king considers what to do, Haman just happens to be standing outside his door. Well, how do we answer those who argue that these coincidences are just too unlikely to be true? Well, first, as we've already said, such comments forget that although God is not mentioned in the book of Esther, God is present in the book of Esther, and with God, all things are possible. Second, fact is stranger than fiction. I mean, I don't need to say much more about that. As we look at some of the things that are making news today, what I just read hardly seems that unlikely. Third, those who make such comments, as I read them, particularly as I read these commentaries launching out into these probabilistic arguments, I think they know about as much about mathematics as they do about theology. There's a difference between picking the lottery winner ahead of time and reporting on who the winner of the lottery was. The first is too improbable to be believable. The second happens every week. We're not looking at some event randomly plucked from history, and oh, look at the coincidences. We're looking at an event chosen because it was so interesting. That's why we have this account in the book of Esther. So that's why it was included in the Bible, because it was so interesting, because these things happened. That's another very strong possibility for why we have it. So the fact that they're looking at it like someone picking the lottery winner, that's ridiculous. And one final note on this point that I just have to mention. These modern scholars who believe Esther is just so improbable that it could never have been true, to a man, they likely believe they evolved through random mutations from single-cell creatures after some big bang blew a bunch of matter apart. Now, let me tell you, when Esther is put alongside that fairy tale, it looks a whole lot more probable. And in fact, this book has a lot to say about coincidence and luck. Are these events in the book just lucky coincidences, or is some greater power involved here? The answer seems clear in Esther. In fact, each of these results, each of these events, by itself might appear to be the result of chance. But taken together, the element of chance just disappears. When you look at them together, you know someone has to be designing this. Someone has to be behind this. And of course, that person is God. It would be like if I took a coin out of my pocket and started flipping, and I flipped four heads in a row. At that point, you're going to be thinking, wow, Eric, he's a pretty lucky guy, four heads in a row. If I flip 40 heads in a row, you're suddenly going to be thinking, he's got a two-headed coin. Luck's not involved. And that's where we are in the book of Esther. We say God is not present in the book of Esther. God is present in the book of Esther, because the book of Esther involves those 40 heads coming up. And that you have to look behind the scenes and ask yourself, who's causing that? And the answer is God. What is the answer regarding the lucky coincidences in our own lives? While it's true that time and chance happens to us all, Ecclesiastes 9, verse 11, not everything that happens to us comes by chance. If God, by His providence, is actively working in this world, then we need to look for His hand. We need to look for that providence, and we need to look for those doors that He is opening for us. The pagans may believe that all we do is governed by chance and that all we are came about by chance, but the Christian knows better than that. Esther can teach us to recognize the providence of God in our own lives. I'm reminded about a story I once read about prayer. In fact, the book was a book about prayer, and the author had written the book about prayer. And he said he was trying to get to sleep one night in advance of some really big talk that he was going to give on the subject of prayer. And there was a dog barking right next door. Yap, yap, yap. And he could not get to sleep. The dog kept barking. He could not get to sleep. So he said he prayed that the dog would stop barking. And the dog immediately stopped barking. And he said he still was unable to sleep for wondering if that had anything to do with his prayer. So, I mean, it's like we need to start to look for God's providence acting in our lives. Do I know? I don't have any clue that had anything to do with his prayer. I don't know much more about him than that, but I've remembered that story. What is the historical setting of the book of Esther? Well, we discussed the history of Persia in our first lesson on Ezra, and we're not going to repeat that here. But what I do want to focus in on briefly is the history of Xerxes, because Xerxes is a king that appears between the two kings in Ezra, Darius and Artaxerxes. Xerxes is in the middle. And again, if you have your handout from lesson one, you might look at that. The events in Esther take place during the reign of Xerxes, who in Hebrew is called Ahasuerus, and that's the name you'll see in the book of Esther, depending on the translation you're using. Xerxes was the king of Persia from 486 until 465. He was preceded, as I said, by Darius, who was the king when the second temple was completed. We just studied that. He was followed by Artaxerxes, who's the king when Ezra and Nehemiah return, and we will study that in the last half of our series of lessons. Our main evidence from this era comes from Herodotus, the Greek historian who wrote Histories of the Persian Wars. And it tells us all about the Persian campaigns against the Greeks. And although Herodotus was a Greek writing about his Persian enemies, and therefore we know he was not an objective source, his books still provide us some good evidence and some good history about the Persian personalities and the Persian practices. For example, he describes Xerxes as tall and handsome, as an ambitious ruler, as a warrior. And in fact, it appears that Herodotus was fascinated by Xerxes because about a third of his book is taken up with the Xerxes' reign. Now, Herodotus describes Xerxes' campaign against the Greeks in 480 and 479, and that ended in a dismal failure. But Xerxes also had some victories. And Herodotus tells us about those. He reconquered Egypt, which had rebelled under Darius, and he also suppressed a rebellion in Babylon. So he had some victories. Perhaps his greatest achievement came through his completion of the palace complex in Persepolis that Darius had begun. It's been called a marvel of grandeur and beauty and luxury. There's a foundation stone has been dug up there that says, "I am Xerxes, the great king." Well, that's the husband of Esther. That's the king we're looking at here in the book of Esther. But Xerxes did have a problem, according to Herodotus and also according to Esther. He did not measure up to the moral quality of his predecessors. And, you know, his predecessors weren't that high on the moral quality scale to begin with, but he didn't measure up to where they had been. One historian notes that Xerxes inherited none of their good qualities, but only a love of opulent display that progressively sapped his moral fiber. He had the weakness, tyrannical character, and love of luxury to be expected in a prince reared in the court, is what we read about Xerxes. Well, in 470, the Persian army again suffered defeat at the hands of the Greeks. And in fact, when that happened in 470, that really ended their 50-year struggle with Greece. And as we know from history, Alexander the Great was not too long after that was going to take over Persia. But Persia at that time still maintained control over Egypt and Cyprus, but they lost control over the Greek colonies. Well, Xerxes was killed after that event in a conspiracy, and he was succeeded by his son, Artaxerxes, who was the king when Ezra and Nehemiah came onto the scene in Ezra chapter 7. So that's a brief history of Esther's husband, King Xerxes. What is the theme of the book of Esther? As you see on your handout, Esther has a remarkable structure. It's a remarkably detailed structure built around a key event in chapter 6 in which the tables are turned between Haman and Mordecai. For each thesis leading up to that event, there is an antithesis that follows it, and you can see those on your handout. Each of those thesis-antithesis pairs reinforces a central theme in the book of Esther, and that central theme is the theme of reversal. In Ezra, we saw the theme of continuity. In Esther, you see the theme of reversal, the theme of reversal. That theme is seen most clearly in Esther 9, verse 1, which has been called the guiding principle of the book. "Now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them." That's the swivel in this book. That's the reversal in this book, right there. That verse, in some ways, is a summary statement of the entire book, and that reversal is played out over and over throughout the book. It emphasizes that events in this book take an unexpected and complete turnaround. In a book that does not refer to God by name, the theme of reversal has the providence of God at its center. At its center. The reversals occur because the actions of powerful people are overruled by the actions of power from a different source, from a much more powerful source, from an infinitely more powerful source, from God. The tables get turned repeatedly in the book of Esther, and God is the great overturner of tables. He turns darkness into light. He turns mourning into rejoicing. He turns defeat into salvation. He turns death into life. Is it an overstatement to say that the theme of reversal is in some ways a theme of the entire Bible? The reversals caused by God, life, death into life, darkness into light. And if so, what does that say about the importance of this oft-neglected little book of Esther? The theme is reversal. Who overturned more tables than Jesus Christ? I'm reminded of a verse we studied in our last series of lessons in this auditorium from Isaiah 52, verse 1. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him, for that which has not been told them they see, and that which they have not heard they understand. Jesus Christ is the great overturner of tables. And we see that theme here in the book of Esther. A second theme we see in the book of Esther that I've already mentioned is feasting. Banquets, feasting. As I mentioned, that word occurs more times in Esther than it does in the rest of the Old Testament combined, almost. The events in Esther open and close with feasting. Feasting occurs throughout the book of Esther. One of the central events in the book is the establishment of a feast that is still celebrated to this day by Jews. Why the emphasis on feasting? The best explanation I found was that it involves the interplay between these two themes. The interplay between feasting and reversal, showing us the interplay between God's providence and human behavior. The feasting being human behavior, the reversal being God's providence. Esther herself, for example, is propelled forward by this interplay. She begins as a pawn, where we see things happening to her rather than through her. But by the end of this book, she is in control and she is acting with authority. Esther 9 and verse 29. Why? Because at the decisive moment, she determined to act. She crossed that boundary. She let God's providence work through her actions, and that's what changed the entire book. It was that boundary and crossing that boundary. From the feast through the reversal to God's providence. That decision led to the reversals in this book. And in fact, God's providence worked through that decision that Esther made. If she had made another decision, God's providence no doubt would have worked through someone else. But she did make that decision, and we can see the outcome of what happened. Do we also see how God is working through our actions today? God's providence works through human actions. That's what we see in the book of Esther. And that's true today. And if we fail to act, if we are inactive, then we are hindering the providence of God in working out His plan. He's working through us to carry out His plan, just as He worked through Esther to carry out His plan in the book of Esther. As we study Esther, we see the providence of God in action. It should remind us of Joseph. Joseph, in many ways, is very similar to Esther. And we see the providence of God working out through the life of Joseph. We see it similarly in the life of Esther. And who can teach us more about reversals than Joseph? Again, the reversals working themselves out in the providence of God. In one way, this ancient tale of intrigue from the Persian court is the most modern book in the Old Testament. Why? Because in this book, God deals with His people the way He deals with us today. Like the Jews of Persia, we have no earthly king. We have no earthly prophet. We have no earthly kingdom. like the Jews of Persia, we live in an age where we don't see miracles, without miracles. Instead, what we see is God working behind the scenes to providentially provide for His people as they live in a hostile and pagan environment. That's what we see, and that's what happens in the book of Esther. What we see is God using those people to fulfill His plans. What we see in Esther is how God's providence works through human action, and we see how it would fail to work through inaction. It would have to look elsewhere. So our question for us, each, individually, as well as a group, is God having to look elsewhere because of our inaction? God is not hidden in Esther, but rather God is veiled. Visions and revelations may come and go, but the veiled presence of God is a constant that may not be seen or felt, but will always sustain His people in good, bad, and ugly times. One commentary wrote, that is the truth that Esther's story celebrates, the providence of God. The events in Esther encourage us to look behind that veil, to understand what's really going on there behind the scenes in a book that doesn't mention God at all. And what better way to illustrate the veiled nature of God than by not mentioning God at all? And that's what this book does. It's emphasizing God's unseen role in history. And is He really that veiled in Esther? When we get to chapter 4, verse 3, we're going to find out what the Jews did when they find out, what Haman ordered. They fasted. What purpose would that have had if not to affect God's will? The veil is pretty thin when we get to chapter 4. We can see God in the background throughout the book of Esther. The providence of God also explains this book's humor. And this book is very humorous. We'll see that. There's a sense of lightness throughout the book, despite the seriousness of the events in the book of Esther. And I think the providence of God explains that. There's a sense of optimism from the outset. These people will survive. They know they will survive. God is on their side. Esther is an optimistic book, and it calls His people to be optimistic. Pessimistic Christian is the ultimate oxymoron. Christians, children of God, must always be optimistic. We have God on our side. Another way to look at Esther is to see it as competing world views. One of those world views is represented by Haman. We've already talked about it a little bit. Luck, fate, coincidence. He's casting lots. He's looking at the gods of fate to see what to do. And that's a belief that pervaded the ancient world. We see it in astrology and omens and magical practices so strongly condemned in the Old Testament. That was one worldview of the time. It's still a worldview today. That ancient worldview, today we call it the New Age. Hardly new. By contrast, the biblical worldview has nothing to do with fatalism. God is the Lord of history. Although He has made men responsible for their decisions and actions, He is the Lord of history. The Bible views history as a dialogue between God and man. God is in control. History is moving forward toward a goal that God has marked. Esther can be seen as a conflict between that worldview and the fatalism of Haman. When was Esther written? Commentaries have much to say about that question. And let me tell you that modern scholars have a very simple method for dating books of the Bible. If the book contains a prophecy about some certain event, then they say that book has to have been written after that event occurred. If the external evidence places the book at some point in time, they'll tell you, well, it must have been written the day before. And if the book dates itself to a certain period in time, the modern scholar will say, well, that couldn't have been when it was written. We see that, for example, in the book of Daniel. They all try to push Daniel as far forward as they can, because otherwise Daniel contains what they themselves would have to admit are accurate prophecies predating the events. But they can't push it past the Dead Sea Scrolls, because there sits Daniel in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And a problem they have is that some of the prophecies in Daniel happened after the Dead Sea Scrolls with the Romans. So what do? They rewrite Daniel to say he was really talking about the Greeks. They will not have prophecies in the Bible. That's how the modern scholar deals with dating books. And they do the same thing with Esther. A problem, though, is that Esther really doesn't contain too many prophecies or any prophecies that cause them to have to push it too forward in time. And most of them say it happened, though, in the Greek period. It was written when the Greeks came to rule. A problem, though, with that is that it doesn't contain any Greek terms. It uses Hebrew much more like the Persian time. So, in fact, what we're going to determine is that Esther was written toward the end of the Persian rule, no later than 350 B.C. I have a little bit more in that in the notes if you'd like to look that up. And, in fact, let me remind you, all of the notes from today's class and all of our classes are available on the Internet at thywordistruth.com, as well as audio and video copies for some of the lessons. So where are we then with the book of Esther? We've looked at the book of Esther. We've looked at the history of the book. We've looked at some reasons why it is a strange book, perhaps the strangest book in the Bible by some measures. But we've also explained that some of that strangeness is there for a reason. That the reason God is not mentioned by name is that the author of Esther wants to tell us something important about God and about how God works in the world and about how God's providence works through our actions. And in a book where God appears hidden, he's really just veiled because he is lurking everywhere underneath the events in the book of Esther. How else do we explain the reversals that occur throughout? And in fact, as we mentioned, reversal is a theme of the book of Esther. And one reason I really like the book of Esther, apart from its comedy, and we are going to see some funny things in the book of Esther, is, as I've mentioned, Esther is showing us, I think, how God works in today's world. So in that sense, it is a very modern book. Next week, we're going to pick up in chapter 1, verse 1 of the book of Esther, and start our working through it. If you could sit down this week or next and read through the entire book, that would be a wonderful way to prepare for these lessons. We're going to move a little more quickly probably than we did through Ezra to try to get through Esther in, I think, 3 weeks. Next week, we have the gospel meeting, so we won't meet here again for our study of Esther until 2 weeks from today. So thank you very much for your attention. Next time we meet, we will start with chapter 1, verse 1 of the book of Esther.